The Theravada places its emphasis fairly and squarely on monasticism, on being a monk, bhikkhu, not a layman. It is the yellow-robed monk who is the real Buddhist. The white-clad layman or laywoman, and even the nun, whether Sinhalese Dasa Sila Mata or Thai Maije, being at best only a second-class Buddhist whose principal duty is to support the monk. Thus, the Theravada's emphasis is on lifestyle, despite the fact that the traditional refuge-going formula is well known to all Theravada Buddhists and is ceremonially recited in Pali by monks and laity alike. Nor is that all. In actual practice, more often than not, it is not so much the spirit as the letter of monasticism which is emphasized, great importance being attached, in particular, to valid monastic ordination in the technical vinaya sense, with the result that although some of the general characteristics of the true Theravada certainly do shine through here and there, today the school as a whole is vitiated by that very formalism of which the Buddha himself, according to the older portions of the Theravada's own Pali Tipitaka, was so persistently critical. I have given examples of this formalism in A Survey of Buddhism and, more recently, in Was the Buddha a Bhikkhu? And there is no need for me to enlarge upon the subject in this paper. Here I am concerned not so much with the Theravada's emphasis on monasticism as with the way in which that emphasis affects our relation to this school and this school's relation to us. But before I turn to the relation of the order to the Theravada, let me make a general point in connection with this question of formalism. Though I have tended in my writings to criticize only Theravada formalism, it should not be thought that other forms of Buddhism are free from this canker. The reason for my criticizing Theravada formalism specifically was that it was Theravada formalism which, in my early days in India, I came across, not to say came up against. Subsequently, I became aware that formalism, whether monastic or non-monastic, was a feature of much traditional Buddhism, almost regardless of school. It was indeed a danger that threatened the integrity of the religious life in all its forms, and one against which even Orthodox Buddhists needed to be on their guard. As the Theravada places its emphasis on monasticism, even on monasticism in the merely formal sense, it sees the Buddhist community as being divided into two distinct groups. On the one hand, there are the monks, who are the real Buddhists. On the other, there are the laity, including the nuns, who are the not-so-real Buddhists, as I once called them, who are expected to feed, clothe, and generally support the monks, and to observe in their dealings with them a protocol expressive of the profoundest veneration. But to which of these groups do members of the Western Buddhist order, Trailokya Bodhimaha Sangha, belong? So far as the Theravada is concerned, the answer is obvious. They belong to the second group, that of the laity. For not having received bhikkhu ordination, there is no question of bhikkhuni ordination in the case of women order members, they are not monks. And there is no other group to which those who are not monks could belong. Hence, when a Theravada monk meets an order member, and it is usually a Theravada monk, not a Theravada layman, especially on official occasions, he will automatically assume that, as the latter obviously is not a monk, he is a layman. As a layman, he will therefore treat him, expecting that the order member, in his turn, will treat him as a monk, with all that this implies. In these circumstances, it is not surprising that there should sometimes arise situations which would be comical were they not based on a lamentable misunderstanding on the part of the Theravada monk of a fundamental principle of the Dharma, the principle, namely, that spiritual attainment has little or nothing to do with socio-religious status, and that one is no more a bhikkhu in the true sense simply because one has been ordained and wears a yellow robe than one is a real Brahmin simply because one has been born into a Brahmin family and wears a sacred thread. An order member might even find himself or herself in the position of being condescendingly put right as regards Buddhism by a globe-trotting career monk who obviously had no feeling for the spiritual life. On the other hand, it is important that when an order member meets a Theravada monk, he or she should be open to the possibility that the former is a real monk, even an orthodox Buddhist, and that it might be possible for one to relate to him, not as a layman, which would mean not really relating to him at all, but on the basis of one's being an order member, that is, on the basis of one's going for refuge, effectively at least, to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. Although there are incomparably more Theravada monks in the East than there are in the West, an order member probably stands a better chance of meeting a real monk and of being able to relate to him on the basis of a common commitment to the three jewels in the West than in the Theravadin lands of Southeast Asia. In the latter, the Theravada is still firmly based on what Reginald A. Ray calls the two-tiered model of Buddhism, which makes it difficult for Buddhists who do not accept that model to extend the hand of spiritual friendship, either literally or metaphorically. How the difficulty might best be overcome, we shall see in connection with the principle of personal contact. Although the Theravada places its emphasis on monasticism, in recent decades there has arisen within its fold a predominantly lay movement, generally known as the Vipassana or insight meditation movement, which emphasizes what is secondary in Buddhism at the expense of what is primary in a different kind of way. This movement, now well represented in the West, had its origins in Myanmar, Burma, in the efforts of a handful of monk and lay teachers to revive and popularize the practice of mindful awareness as taught by the Buddha in his discourse on the foundations of mindfulness. Nowadays, unfortunately, some of the movement's leading personalities not only emphasize meditation in the sense of insight meditation at the expense of going for refuge, they also ignore going for refuge completely. In extreme cases, having reduced meditation to vipassana and vipassana itself to a matter of mere technique, they take it out of its Buddhist context and seek to combine it with elements derived from other sources, so that it is no longer vipassana in the traditional sense, but something quite different. To the extent that one is a practitioner of this non-Buddhist vipassana, one is not a Buddhist, whether the Theravada or any other school, and there can be no question of an order member relating to such a person on the basis of a common going for refuge, though he or she may relate to them positively in other ways. The fact that the order does not emphasize monasticism does not mean that there is no place for it within our ranks. There is certainly a place for sutra-style monasticism, as I have called it, in 43 years ago, though there is a place for it only as an expression of commitment to the three jewels, not as constitutive of that commitment. And I'm glad to see that since I wrote that little book 3 years ago, the number of order members observing the training rule of chastity as anagarikas has doubled from 20-odd to 40-odd. Similarly, the fact that the order does not emphasize meditation in the sense of insight meditation at the expense of going for refuge does not mean that there is no place in it for vipassana in the more traditional form, which is common in principle to practically all schools of Buddhism. Much less does it mean that we do not regard the development of both calm, shamatha, and insight, vipassana, as essential elements in our spiritual life.